Okay, Erev Tov to everyone. Welcome to part 7 of the series, The Presidents of the Jews. Tonight we're discussing the mediocrities. Zachary Taylor, Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan. I want to start with a clarification of a point that I made last time. I was wary of the claims that John Tyler's grandchildren were still alive. So someone emailed me, but I already looked into it. In fact, I mean, it's just amazing longevity. So Tyler, of course, was the president 1841 to 1845. And recall, his wife died, and he married a woman 30 years younger. So he had children up to 2 years before he died. He had a son named Lyon Gardner Taylor, who did the same thing. His wife died when he was in his 70s, and he married a much younger woman in his 70s. Pasuk says, "Baboker zra ezarecha ulerev al tanach yodecha," and he had two sons born in the 1920s, one in 1924, one in 1928, and they're still alive. One is 91 and one is 87, so Tyler was born a year after Washington was president. So in fact, you have in Tyler and his grandsons, every president of the United States has lived with a Tyler, which is just astonishing. But, nonetheless, so we wish them good health. What's that? Arichas Yomim, indeed, at least. That's, I mean, from father to grandson, it's 225 years already between grandfather and grandsons. It's amazing. I mean, when Tyler was born, the girl was still alive, and, you know. Okay, well, if you haven't yet noticed, if you follow the papers, we've had bad presidents in this country. Incompetence, disconnected, inferior, mediocrities, people who did not rise to the occasion and were incapable of responding to the challenges of their generation. They usually meant well or mean well. The worst among them are arrogantly convinced of their rectitude and wisdom, and the foolishness and venality of their opponents. But we do have to be somewhat wary while sitting in judgment. You know, there's a tendency to judge our forebears more harshly based on contemporary morals, and especially based on how history played itself out. So hindsight is 20/20, and in retrospect, we always think we would have made different decisions. That's sometimes true, sometimes false. And even good decisions can lead to unwelcome results, and even bad decisions might have had different outcomes if just one or two circumstances had changed. So that being said, these four presidents, the mediocrities, Taylor, who was the 12th, and Fillmore, the 13th, Pierce, the 14th, and Buchanan, the 15th, dealt with the most pressing issue of the day, slavery and the growing divide between the North and the South, by tacitly accepting it, striving for peace in their time, and primarily by kicking the can down the road, even as the situation worsened. All that accomplished was leaving their eventual successor, Abraham Lincoln, to deal with secession and civil war and the bloodiest war by far in American history. So could it all have ended differently if the leadership in the 1850s had been up to the task and had used their powers of persuasion, and together with Congress, tamed the growling beast? Who knows? It's one of history's tantalizing what-ifs. It could very well be that the Civil War was bound to happen anyway. In essence, it was the final battle of the Revolution, finally deciding the one vexing issue that went unresolved at the Constitutional Convention, and that's the institution of slavery. On the other hand, it could have been that some other arrangement could have been made, especially with stronger leadership. Let's look at the first of the four tonight, Zachary Taylor. Few people have been elected president with as little known about their policies as Zachary Taylor. He was probably the only president ever elected who had never even voted before. Never cast a vote in any election. And he was the first president ever elected without ever having been elected to any prior office, obviously excluding Washington, but no, even Washington served in the House of Burgesses. Eisenhower was the last, just to by reference. Eisenhower also was not elected any office before the presidency. And I understand that one or two people now running for president also never been elected to anything before. Now, Taylor had no formal education, but was a career soldier. That's how he made his reputation, and those were his qualifications. He was born in 1784. He grew to be short, stocky, nicknamed Old Rough and Ready, because he had no interest in pomp and ceremony, in dress uniforms, in formality, unlike some of these other generals. He was born into Virginia nobility. He was a second cousin to James Madison. He and Madison shared a great-grandfather. He was a more distant cousin to Robert E. Lee, who also fought in the Mexican War, and then became, of course, the legendary general of the Confederate armies. And Taylor, who had six children, was also the father-in-law, briefly, to Jefferson Davis, who became the president of the Confederacy. Taylor did not want him as a son-in-law. Told him that. Not always a good thing to do. He didn't want his daughter to marry a soldier. Davis almost challenged Taylor to a duel, which is one way to plan for a wedding also. But Taylor eventually relented. The couple married, but sadly the daughter, Davis's wife, Sarah Knox Taylor, died of malaria just a few months after they married. And they reconciled when Davis served heroically under Taylor's command in Mexico. Now, Taylor inherited a plantation from his father, but he sold that, and he later bought a large plantation in Louisiana, where he had 145 slaves working for him. So Taylor was pro-slavery, but as strange as it sounds, we come back to this again and again, he was pro-slavery in a very benign way. He accepted the institution, but he treated his slaves humanely, and he always referred to them as servants, never as slaves, in his writings, messages he sent when he was at war. He would always refer to them as servants. They were never mistreated, always well fed, and he was even known to distribute cash bonuses to them at the end of the year, which was unheard of in that time. He never sold a slave. He didn't like to see them as chattel, but as people, and many of his slaves had long relationships with him. But because he treated his slaves with kindness, he did not empathize with the criticisms of slavery by Northerners or abolitionists. He spent his career in the military, fought the War of 1812, mainly fought Indians, but he achieved his greatest fame in the Mexican War, being the first to cross the Rio Grande, leading troops in several historic battles. Some of them, his troops were greatly outnumbered, and he suffered substantial casualties, but Taylor was always on the front line. He didn't stay in the back. On the front line, exhorting his men, personally directing the course of the battle, and his men were very dedicated to him. He became a national figure in 1846 after the Battle of Monterrey, where his outnumbered army fought in street combat and forced the Mexican general into negotiating the surrender of the city after a two-month armistice. After the 2 months, Taylor allowed the Mexicans to leave. He took over the city, but he was lambasted by Polk, the president, who wanted him to kill the enemy, not negotiate a truce and surrender. But this caused a great hubbub in Congress, whose Whig contingent supported Taylor, and this made Taylor a national figure. In response, pettiness is not something new, Polk gutted Taylor's army, left him with even fewer troops, and he suffered even greater casualties, but still won. He fought in the Battle of Buena Vista, again suffered casualties. Jefferson Davis seriously wounded. Henry Clay's son was killed in that battle, but he prevailed anyway. In response, he wrote to a friend a letter critical of Polk, meant to be private, famous last words. The friend leaked the letter to the press, and that further boosted Taylor's national profile. So he began to be mentioned as a presidential possibility in 1848, and by both parties, again similar to Eisenhower. He was nominated by the Whigs on the fourth ballot, but he did not officially learn of his nomination for months, for a good reason. The Whig sent him a letter of acceptance, but it was postage due, and Taylor refused to pay the 10 cents for the letter. He had been receiving so many letters about the war that if they're postage due, he just didn't accept them. Among those letters was one from the Whigs. It took some time for him to find out. Once he didn't find out, look, he was a cipher, basically. Taylor's political views were unknown. He obviously supported slavery because he had slaves, but that didn't necessarily mean that... That didn't necessarily mean that he supported extending slavery into newly admitted states, just like he had Northerners who opposed slavery, were not necessarily all free soilers. So in that he disagreed, of course, with his son-in-law, Davis. Taylor defeated Michigan Senator Lewis Cass in a close election, 47% to 43%, each won 15 states, with the remainder going to Martin Van Buren, still chugging along, trying to get back to the White House, garnering 10% of the vote. True to his enigmatic form, Taylor appointed cabinet officers from north to south, holding all sorts of views. He wasn't president for long, really, the second shortest tenure after Harrison. Just 16 months after he took office, he died July 9th, 1850. Now, he dealt mainly with the slavery issue, and the Compromise of 1850 was negotiated while he was president, but he did not live to sign it. He wouldn't have signed it anyway, which is part of the story. The compromise was engineered by Clay, and it allowed California to enter the Union as a free state. It stopped Texas's western land grab, so slavery would not extend there, but slavery was not barred in any new federal territories. In fact, Taylor would have banned the extension of slavery, defying the South, so had he lived, it never would have been adopted. In fact, Taylor expressed no hesitation about blockading southern ports and crushing any secession attempt. So when the compromise was being negotiated, and states from the South were making noise about seceding, Taylor openly threatened that he would crush any rebellion if they tried to break apart the Union. Had he done so, that would have averted the costly Civil War a decade later, so no Southern state made any serious attempt to secede. Now, being a career Army man out in the boondocks, meant that Zachary Taylor would have very little interaction with Jews. And indeed that was so. During the 1840s, Jewish immigrants from Germany swelled the ranks of the Jewish population, but did not necessarily bring to them a strict observance of mitzvahs. So you find during Taylor's term, we have the first resignation of a rabbi in America, from Rabbi Abraham Rice, usually assumed to be the first rabbi in 19th century America. Rabbi Rice was born in Germany. He learned in the yeshivos in Würzburg and in Fürth. He received smicha and came to America with his wife in 1840, shortly thereafter becoming the rabbi of Nidre Yisrael in Baltimore. So he became the go-to rabbi in America at the time, the only one qualified to answer halachic questions. Previously, as a contemporary wrote about American Jewish life and the rabbinate, so to speak, here a man qualifies himself, ordains himself. He's his own college, his own professor, his own diploma. He is what he claims to be. We are reverting to that, by the way, today also. Now, in theory, it was a good fit. In actuality, not. The shul consisted mainly of German Jews who were nominally Orthodox, but Rabbi Rice learned soon enough that many of these Orthodox Jews worked on Shabbos and ate treif. So he banned them from receiving aliyos in shul. That did not go over well. He relented under tremendous pressure, but he directed people not to answer amen to their brachos, which did not endear him to his shul either. At one point, he wrote to his Rebbe, Reb Wolf Hamburger in Fürth, I quote, "I dwell in complete isolation, without a teacher or companion in this land whose atmosphere is not conducive to wisdom. All shilas are brought to me for solution. I have to carry the full load on my shoulders, and have to assume the authority to render decisions in halachic questions in both private and public matters. And one more thing I wish to disclose to you, my revered master and teacher, and my soul weeps in the dark on account of it, namely that the character of religious life in this land is on the lowest level. Most of the people are eating non-kosher food, are violating the Shabbos in public, and there are thousands who have been assimilated among the non-Jewish population and have married non-Jewish women. Under these circumstances, my mind is perplexed, and I wonder whether a Jew may live in a land such as this. This is Rabbi Rice in the late 1840s. He otherwise spent his time fighting the two major Reform rabbis of his era, Isaac Meir Wise and David Einhorn, who were doing their best to destroy Torah and mitzvahs in America. In 1849, during the Taylor administration, Rabbi Rice had enough. He resigned and opened up a dry goods store and then a grocery store, but he went out with a bang, good musa for all Rabbanim, telling his shul in his last drasha, I quote, "I am aware that my sermons have caused me much trouble and grief. My conscience further says to me, it is your rabbinic responsibility to teach the right path of our religion, regardless of consequences to yourself. One must be prepared to sacrifice comfort and tranquility and even abandon one's occupation in the interest of truth. One should not be afraid to speak openly against the wealthy and influential, the powerful, regardless of the consequences." End quote. And sayonara. Within a few years, he could no longer daven at Nidchei Yisrael. He opened up a small shtiebel where he served as the Rav. He called the Sheres Yisrael, and that became the Orthodox German Shul in Baltimore. He died in 1862. By 1861, Nidchei Yisrael officially became Reform. July 4th, 1850, Zachary Taylor, celebrating American independence, consumed raw cherries and iced milk. Memo, don't do that. For whatever reason, he fell ill and he died 5 days later. There are such persistent reports that he had been poisoned by arsenic, assassinated, that 25 years ago, I think it was 1991, his body was exhumed and examined, and no traces of arsenic were found, but it is now assumed he died from acute gastroenteritis. He was succeeded by his vice president, Millard Fillmore. Now, Fillmore was a New Yorker born in 1800 in Locke, New York, Cayuga County. And he was nominated to be vice president for ticket balance. He filled a unique demographic, the northerner who was neutral on slavery. Now, Fillmore came from poverty. He was actually born in a log cabin, but he carried himself like an aristocrat. He was tall and robust physically, but in his young teens, he failed at several apprentice jobs. In the interim, he taught himself to read, and as a teenager, even carried a dictionary around with him. You know the good thing about a dictionary? All the other books are in it. So he just read the dictionary, and Fillmore actually established the first library in the White House. He went to school very late, only as a older teenager, and there he met his future wife, Abigail, who taught there, and they married, and he came to the attention of a local judge who urged him to study law, and he hired him as a clerk. Within a few years, Fillmore became one of the top lawyers in Buffalo, and from there was elected to the New York State Assembly. He lost a run for governor in 1844, but he came to the attention of the Whigs for his attacks on Polk, and especially his opposition to the Mexican War. He claimed that the North's interests had to suffer because the South wanted to acquire more territory to expand slavery. To his shock, he was nominated for vice president in 1848. Very odd when you consider that the top of the ticket's reputation was made in the war, the Mexican War, that Fillmore opposed. But he was very intelligent. Fillmore is a persuasive speaker, despite not being a great orator, and he helped Taylor win the election. Personally, he was opposed to slavery, but he felt it was an issue that had to be left to each state to decide. And by the way, that's a very familiar trope in American history down to today. How many people say, especially liberal Catholic politicians. I'm personally opposed to abortion, but the law is the law. Well, Fillmore basically adopted the same approach as others about slavery. Fillmore signed the Compromise of 1850 that Taylor would not have, that did nothing to solve the problem of slavery, but ensured another decade of relative, and I emphasize relative, tranquility, even as the problem festered. For the first time in American history, Fillmore offered a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court to a Jew. He wasn't much of a Jew. But Judah P. Benjamin, born in 1811 in St. Croix, in the British Virgin Islands, to Sephardic Jews, his mother's family, direct descendants of Golay Sfarad, in 1492. When he was a toddler, the family moved to Fayetteville, North Carolina, and then to Charleston, where he was raised. Unusual for the time, especially for Sfardim, his family joined the Reform Temple, were not at all observant, gave Judah Benjamin no Jewish education at all, but he became the first U.S. senator who was Jewish and did not convert. You remember David Levy, David Yulee, who had converted. Benjamin remained a Jew, even though he married a Catholic. It was a terrible marriage. She lived most of the time in France with their one child, who was rumored not to be Benjamin's child. She had a reputation also. And it was while serving as senator from Louisiana that Benjamin became a major landowner and slaveholder. Then Fillmore asked him to serve in the Supreme Court. Benjamin, who had been educated at Yale but did not graduate, rejected the offer, preferring to remain in the Senate. He was always a colorful, flamboyant figure. He eventually became Attorney General and then Secretary of State of the Confederacy, and he escaped after the war to avoid prosecution and lived the rest of his life, practiced law in England. His face appeared on the $2 Confederate bill, which is not worth much. I should note that generally, Jews in the South were subjected to anti-Jewish sentiments that always existed, and occasionally rose above the surface. But other than that, they were tolerated. It was, and the nature of the anti-Jewishness was in the genre of Jews as materialists, as money-grubbing, as Shylocks, as swindlers, etc. But it was rarely overt and blatant, owing to the fact that Jews mostly assimilated, and blacks served as handy scapegoats, and there was relative prosperity in the South. So Jews floated above the whatever type of dissonance in society existed. Fillmore figured into Jewish life in another way as well. In 1850, America's representative in Switzerland, A. Dudley Mann, negotiated a trade agreement with the Swiss that, consistent with Swiss law, allowed commercial privileges in trade only to Christians and not Jews. Jews were barred at the time from even entering many cantons in Switzerland. When Fillmore submitted this treaty to the Senate for approval, many Jews and others publicly protested that there should not be discrimination in trade against any American, even Jews. Fillmore, his Secretary of State, Daniel Webster, prominent Jews like Isaac Leeser, who we've spoken about in the past, Captain Jonas Phillips Levy, the younger brother of Uriah Phillips Levy, the Commodore, and others publicly opposed the treaty, and then in the end so did Fillmore, and the treaty was rejected by Congress, left to be renegotiated. A few years later, it was resurrected with supposedly more innocuous language and ratified, but the Swiss maintained their policy and even expelled an American Jewish businessman named Gutmann from the country. So this provoked public protest in America in 1857, and it was resolved only by a special waiver given to Gutmann, but not to other Jews. And the policy, in fact, remained in place until 1874, when the new Swiss constitution gave Jews full civil rights. Fillmore, like Tyler before him, had not been elected to the presidency, had no real base, had offended many Whigs by signing into law the Fugitive Slave Act that obligated even Northerners to help return escaped slaves to their Southern masters. So in 1852, Fillmore sought the Whig Party's nomination as president, and he did not get it. the Whigs nominated another Mexican war hero, General Winfield Scott, and he was defeated in the general election by Franklin Pierce of New Hampshire. So Fillmore was out, adding injury to insult at Pierce's inauguration in 1853 in another Washington snowstorm. Echoes of William Henry Harris in 1841, Fillmore's wife caught pneumonia and died within a few weeks. He tried again to run for president in 1856, and he would fail then too. One of the problems we should acknowledge faced by the United States in the 1850s was the lackluster leadership, especially in Congress, suffered in a two-year span from 1850 to 1852. Three giants, John C. Calhoun, Henry Clay, and Daniel Webster, all died, leaving the nation with very few legislators with any national influence. And the presidents were people who largely decided just to delay everything, were passive, allowed the problems to fester rather than attempt painful solutions. But all the delaying meant that the problem, slavery, would exacerbate as the country expanded. Whenever it would come, the resolution, whenever it would come, would be even deadlier than it otherwise might have been. Truman said of Fillmore, when we needed a strong man, what we got was a man that swayed with the slightest breeze. He couldn't have been any more impressed with Pierce. Pierce was not much better. In fact, Franklin Pierce was known to respond to any confrontation by fainting. Not what you want in a president. He was also widely known as an alcoholic, although he tried to abstain while he was in the White House. He tried. I don't know if he succeeded. When he wasn't renominated in 1856, he said, "There's nothing left but to get drunk." And that was it. So Pierce was born in 1804 in a log cabin in New Hampshire, into a prominent family. He was well educated. I think my wife and I visited the Pierce birthplace about 2 years ago in New Hampshire. Nice birthplace. He had a reputation as a bit of a rascal. He was a supporter of Andrew Jackson, and he worked his way up the state political chain, becoming a congressman in the 1830s. He had a very sad, tragic private life. He married a local girl, Jane, shy, sickly, strange as it sounds, an active supporter of the temperance movement. In fact, Pierce became the head of the temperance movement in New Hampshire in the 1840s in the hopes that he would finally remove the addiction, the alcohol addiction, from him. But they had three sons, all of whom died young, two of illness, and the last, age 11, died in a train crash after Pierce was elected president, but just weeks before his term started. Pierce himself was almost killed in the crash also, but his son was the only fatality right in front of he and his wife's eyes. They both fell into a depression. She never recovered. She didn't go to the inauguration even. And he also never really emerged from it and then got back to his drinking. Pierce served in Congress, fought in the Mexican War, became a candidate for president in 1852 because he had the right profile. A northerner who was a moderate opponent of slavery but would do nothing about it and even favor the extension of slavery. This, in 1852, was one of the most contentious conventions in American history. The early contestants were Cass, who had lost in 1848, and James Buchanan, who would win in 1856, but Pierce was nominated on the 49th ballot. That's a long time. That's days. All right, people are talking about a brokered convention this year for the Republicans. Imagine going 49 ballots. Pierce wasn't even mentioned in the first 10, 12 ballots or so. His drinking was already well known. It's a great quote. His opponents called him the hero of many a well-fought bottle. But he won 51-44% over Winfield Scott, becoming at 48 the youngest president until then. In the White House, Pierce did little to distinguish himself. He was the only president not to say, "I do solemnly swear," upon taking the oath. but I do solemnly affirm, which the Constitution allows as well. And he was once, talk of anonymity, he was once arrested while president for riding over a woman with his horse, RUI, riding under the influence. He was released only when the police realized that he was the president. Jefferson Davis was his Secretary of War. So Pierce, in his time, supported the Kansas-Nebraska Act that broke the consensus of the Missouri Compromise in 1820, embittered the North, which felt was a power play to allow the South to seize land for slavery all the way to the Pacific. Senator Stephen Douglas and a young congressman, Abraham Lincoln, debated 7 times about this bill, with Lincoln for the first time airing his anti-slavery views in the famous Peoria speech. Here's Lincoln. "Nearly 80 years ago, we began by declaring that all men are created equal. But now from that beginning, we have run down to the other declaration that for some men to enslave others is a sacred right of self-government. These principles cannot stand together. They are as opposite as God and mammon, and whoever holds to the one must despise the other." Lincoln and Douglas, of course, would debate again in 1858 as rival candidates for Senate, and then, of course, they faced each other in 1860 as well. Pierce has a unique distinction regarding Jews, at least. Until 1856, the laws in the District of Columbia barred the establishment of any Jewish house of worship. So that law was repealed during Pierce's term, and the Washington Hebrew Congregation was chartered in 1855, actually began illegally anyway, in 1852. And Pierce's name appears on the synagogue charter. He's the only president to have his name on a synagogue charter. This synagogue was Reform in orientation. Pierce also appointed the first Jew as minister to a country. Ambassador. You know, the U.S. didn't use the term ambassador until 1893. So he appointed a wealthy German Jew named August Belmont as minister to The Hague. He also wasn't much of a Jew. He was a German immigrant sent here by the Rothschild banking empire in the 1830s as their representative. So he changed his name from Schoenberg to Belmont. Get it? Schoenberg, beautiful mountain. Belmont sounds French and not German. He became an Episcopalian, and he married the daughter of Commodore Matthew Perry. He founded Belmont Racetrack. That's his enduring claim to fame. A Jewish-owned horse won there a few months ago, is it something? Became a major fundraiser and supporter of the Democratic Party, where he found himself in the position to be appointed ambassador. He was the first, but there's a first for everything. Pierce also expected to be renominated for president in 1856, only to be rejected by his party. He and his wife traveled abroad for several years, and Pierce always exhorted his northern base not to do anything that would provoke southern secession. It didn't work. Pierce died in 1869 of, cirrhosis of the liver. He was succeeded by James Buchanan. Now, Buchanan was born in 1791 in Pennsylvania. He sought the presidency for almost 15 years and is the last person who served as Secretary of State to be elected president. Buchanan had been Polk's Secretary of State. So if Hillary Clinton wants to win or is the nominee, the Republicans should use as their slogan, "We don't need another James Buchanan as president." Buchanan actually had a very distinguished career in the House, in the Senate, as ambassador to Russia, and then ambassador to the UK in the mid-1850s. So he's out of the country during the Pierce debacle, and that helped him. He was a very successful lawyer, very wealthy lawyer in Pennsylvania. He's most famous, of course, for being the only bachelor president, the only president never to marry. His niece served as the First Lady, and that's fueled speculation going back to his time that he was a homosexual. He did live for 10 years with Rufus King. This is in the 1840s. In the 1850s, King was Pierce's vice president, and King was a known homosexual. They lived together in a boarding house for 10 years in the 1840s. Andrew Jackson routinely referred to Rufus King as Miss Nancy or Aunt Fancy, which were considered derogatory at the time. Buchanan, we don't know. Buchanan was engaged to a woman he loved, Ann Coleman, but when she heard rumors that he was cavorting with other women and also was inattentive to him because of his law practice, which was elected to Congress, she broke off the engagement, and then she died of sudden illness just a few weeks later. Buchanan says he was crushed, and that's why he never married, but who knows. Buchanan was nominated on the 17th ballot. He won 45% of the vote in the general election, defeating John C. Fremont of California, got a third of the vote. And the hapless Millard Fillmore, who now ran as the candidate of the Know-Nothing Party, anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, got 22% of the vote. But at least we should say something in Fillmore's chus. Apparently he was nominated when he was out of the country, did not offer himself, had no idea he was nominated, he got back to the country. So I don't know if he actively campaigned. Buchanan had to deal with the continuing saga of the Swiss commercial treaty that discriminated against Jews, left over from the Pierce administration, and he supported the Jews, but he really didn't resolve anything, and he refused to amend the treaty again, and so it came into law. And similarly, he involved himself in the notorious Murtara affair by essentially doing nothing. This story we've discussed in the past. In 1858, six-year-old Edgardo Murtara was snatched from his Jewish parents' home in Bologna, Italy, by agents of the papal police, pursuant to the authority of Pope Pius IX. The child had been allegedly baptized by the family maid when he was ill. She confessed this to a priest, and under Catholic law, and Bologna was part of the papal states, non-Catholics were not allowed to raise a Catholic child. So the police came and just kidnapped Edgardo from his parents' arms. He was taken to Rome. He was raised in a convent for converts as a Catholic for long periods of time. He was not allowed to see his grieving parents. And this became an international cause célèbre, with Jews around the world protesting this outrage. The Pope was not only unmoved, he was dismissive of the protests, even met with the Murtara's parents and asserted he would do the same thing again. Personal appeals by the parents went in vain. A Jewish self-help group, really the first of our time, was founded in France by Adolphe Crémieux, the Alliance Israélite Universelle, to deal with such attacks on Jewish rights and Jewish dignity. In America, Jews went to Buchanan to enlist his assistance, following the tradition established when Martin Van Buren intervened diplomatically on behalf of the Jews of Damascus after the blood libel of 1840. Well, Buchanan was no Van Buren. He refused to get involved. He did not even want to criticize the Vatican, and he told the delegation of Jews that visited that he did not want to intervene in the internal affairs of another state, and that such action might legitimize European condemnation of our own domestic institution of slavery. I quote Buchanan, "I've long been convinced that it is neither the right nor the duty of this government to exercise a moral censorship over the conduct of other independent governments, and to rebuke them for acts which we may deem arbitrary and unjust toward their own citizens. Such a practice would tend to embroil us with all nations. We ourselves would not permit any foreign power thus to interfere with our domestic concerns and enter protests against the legislation for the action of our government toward our citizens. If such an attempt were made, we should promptly advise such a government to return to confine themselves to their own affairs and not to intermeddle with our concerns." So indeed, the American skeleton in the closet of slavery precluded preaching to any other country as Buchanan sought. And in this, Buchanan was supported by many Jewish leaders in the South, especially in Charleston, who had the same fear and so refused to criticize Buchanan publicly. And that distinction between the Jews in the North and the Jews in the South diluted what little influence the Jewish community might have had under the best of circumstances. In fact, at an 1859 Jewish organizational banquet in New Orleans, Rahman al-Islam, Jewish organizational banquets go back so far, and they show no sign of ending. This is for the New Orleans Association for the Relief of Jewish Widows and Orphans. The leading Jews, all slave owners, all who'd become supporters of the Confederacy, praised Buchanan for his handling of the Mortara affair. Now, interestingly, around the same time, a very similar case happened in New Orleans. A Catholic nurse took a child, Alice Levy, of a dying mother and placed her in a convent to be raised as a Catholic. And the Jewish community mobilized and was able to get her back, and she was taken in by this association. Ultimately, Edgardo Mortara became a priest. He lived a long life. He died in Belgium in an abbey in 1940. Just 2 months before the Nazis invaded and conquered Belgium. Meanwhile, Pope Pius IX was beatified, one step removed from sainthood, by John Paul the Deuce in 2000, to wide disapproval, because he was a Russia, like many popes named Pius. Now, Buchanan's presidency was a complete failure. Few presidents come to office with as much experience as did Buchanan, but he was passive when he wasn't altogether being obtuse. He deferred to Congress. He took the lead in nothing. He became an appeaser of slavery, and he worsened relations between North and South. By the time of the 1860 conventions, all the parties had split into Northern and Southern factions. And after the election, before Lincoln would take office, political warfare would degenerate into open hostilities between North and South, with the first exchange of gunfire at Fort Sumter. By the time Lincoln became president on March 4, 1861, 7 states had already seceded, and the Confederacy was a month old. So Lincoln really inherited a split nation and a civil war. And the only question was, could the Union be saved? And should the Union be saved? Buchanan, for his part, rejoiced when his term ended, and he claimed that history would vindicate his tenure as president. He was wrong about that, too. So, we ended last time with a discussion of the involvement of American Jews in the slave trade, or as slave owners. It existed, but relatively was very minimal. But what of Jewish attitudes towards slavery? On what side of the debate did we fall? Well, it shouldn't surprise anyone to discover we were on all sides of the debate. And the relevance here is not to suggest that somehow Jews played a critical role in resolving this issue or not, but that Jewish attitudes reflected the intractability of slavery. Jews especially, a minority that suffered greatly as a minority throughout the exile, treasured stability in government, in society. And everyone knew that resolving the issue of slavery would require destabilizing the society. That and one other factor, again, it sounds paradoxical, the realization of Dina de Mechusa Dina. Slavery, even assuming its immorality, was the law of the land. And we are taught to respect the law of the land. And respect for the law of the land fosters peace and stability. And that helps us. Kivish Shlomo, Yelachem Shalom, like the Navi Yirmiyo promised us. There were Jews, there were Jews primarily in the South who were pro-slavery, which is the way things were. But there were also religious defenses that were mounted in support of slavery as well. Not many outside the South, but one in particular became very famous, Rabbi Morris Rafal, who was the rabbi of B'nai Jeshurun in New York City. It was the second oldest shul, the Ashkenazi breakaway in 1825 from She'eris Israel. it was established to follow the Minhagim of Poland and Germany. Remember, Sheretz Yisrael was Spanish-Portuguese, and it was nominally Orthodox. It still exists today. It became Reform in 1878, left Reform in 1884, supported the founding of the JTS, became conservative, and then it became officially independent in the 1990s. Rabbi Rafal was Swedish-born, educated in Germany, became a Rav here in 1849. He was, in fact, the first rabbi to deliver an invocation before Congress. So on the eve of the Civil War, January 4th, 1861, exactly 2 months before Lincoln was sworn in, and 1 week after South Carolina had seceded from the Union, Rafal gave a legendary sermon at B'nai Jeshurun in which he defended slavery. And he castigated those who held it was a sin against the Bible to keep other human beings as slaves. And he began with the usual disclaimer, he's personally opposed to slavery, etc., etc. But the notion that the Bible denounces slavery, he said, is a pernicious fallacy. And I quote, "If we consult sacred scripture, the oldest and most truthful collection of records now or at any time in existence, we find the word eved, slave, which the English version renders servant, first used by Noah, who in Genesis curses the descendants of his son Ham by saying they should be eved avadim, the meanest of slaves, the English version, servant of servants. The question naturally arises, how came Noah to use the expression? How came he to know anything of slavery? There existed not at that time any human being on earth except Noah and his family of three sons, apparently by one mother, born free and equal with their wives and children. Noah had no slaves. From the time he quitted the ark, he could have none. It therefore becomes evident that Noah's acquaintance with the word slave and the nature of slavery must date from before the flood, and existed in his memory only until the crime of Ham called it forth. You and I may regret that in his anger, Noach should from beneath the waters of wrath again have fished up the idea and practice of slavery." It's a good simile, by the way. "But that he did so is a fact which rests on the authority of Scripture. I am therefore justified when tracing slavery as far back as it can be traced. I arrive at the conclusion that next to the domestic relations of husband and wife, parents and children, the oldest relation of society with which we are acquainted is that of master and slave." And he went on, "Is slaveholding condemned as a sin in sacred scripture? How this question can at all arise in the mind of any man that has received a religious education and is acquainted with the history of the Bible is a phenomenon I cannot explain to myself, and which 50 years ago no man dreamed of. But we live in times when we must not be surprised at anything. Last Sunday, an eminent preacher is reported to have declared from the pulpit, the Old Testament requirements serve their purpose during the physical and social development of mankind, and were rendered no longer necessary now when we are to be guided by the superior doctrines of the new in the moral instruction of the race. I had always thought that in the moral instruction of the race, the requirements of the Jewish scriptures and Christian scriptures were identically the same, that to abstain from murder, theft, adultery, to do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God, were requirements equally imperative in the one course of instruction as in the other. But it appears I was mistaken. Say what you wish, but Yovesh Chatzir Navel Tzitz Udvar Elokeinu Yakum La'olam. From the Torah for Shabbos Nachamu, the grass will wither, the flower will fade, but the word of God shall endure forever. And he said, look, Shabbos, the Torah admonishes that we abstain from melacha, but not only we, avdecha v'amascha. So of course the institution is sanctioned by the Bible. And he says, my friends, I find, and I'm sorry to find, that I am delivering a pro-slavery discourse. I am no friend to slavery in the abstract, and still less friendly to the practical working of slavery. But I stand here as a teacher in Israel, not to place before you my own feelings and opinions, but to propound to you the Word of God, the Bible view of slavery. With a due sense of my responsibility, I must state to you the truth and nothing but the truth, however unpalatable or unpopular that truth may be, and the peg on which the abolitionists base their policy, lo tazgir eved el adonov asher yinatzer leilecho mim adonov, not to return the escaped slave to the master. He said that halacha is that applies to escape, a slave who escapes his master in chutz laaretz and flees to Israel. So there he finds refuge. But a slave within Israel would be returned to his master. And he called for everyone to take a step back from the edge of calamity. As the cry of the prophet, yet 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown, alarm that people. So the proclamation, the union is dissolved, has startled the inhabitants of the United States. The president, the chief officer, placed at the helm to guide the vessel of the Commonwealth on its course, stands aghast at the signs of the times. He sees the black clouds gathering overhead. He hears the fierce howl of the tornado and the hoarse roar of the breakers all around him. He went on for hours, by the way. Now, he wasn't the greatest Talmud Chacham, to be sure, but he held the Torah condoned slavery. Now, of course, even the slavery in the Torah was much more benign than the slavery practiced in the South, especially as the Eved Kenani became, for all intents and purposes, a member of the family, entitled to special treatment when free in the case of physical abuse that cost him even a tooth, and was even obligated certain mitzvos, and certainly Eved Ivri, Kolakona Eved Ivri, Kona Adon La'atzmo. You acquire a Hebrew slave, you've acquired a master for yourself. He has to be fed first, even. So both were more akin to servitude, the latter an attempt to rehabilitate, as Eved Ivri, the straying Jew, by placing him in a family environment, much more than to American slavery. Rabbi Rafal was not alone. That same day, January 4th, 1861, a Friday, as I recall it, had been declared a fast day in America for Jews. And in Baltimore, Rabbi Bernard Illowy, Yaakov Yehuda Illowy, addressed the assembled. So Rabbi Illowy was also German-born. He was a Talmud Chassam Sofer. He came to America in 1852, first to Anshei Ches in New York, then to Philadelphia, then to Nidchei Yisrael in Baltimore, the place that Rabbi Rice had escaped. He was a person of a very acerbic nature. He once remarked that there are four musmachim in America, himself and the other three are Talmidim of Bilam HaRosha. So he usually preached on Shabbos an average of 45 to 60 minutes. And if he spoke shorter than that, his congregation would ask him if he's feeling all right. They would complain if it was too short. I've had the same experience, by the way, once. Now, he also defended slavery, saying, who can blame our brethren of the South for seceding from a society whose government cannot or will not protect the property rights and privileges of a great portion of the Union against the encroachments of a majority misguided by some influential, ambitious aspirants and selfish politicians who, under the color of religion and the disguise of philanthropy, have thrown the country into a general state of confusion and millions into want and poverty. Now, word of that speech got out, and Rav Illowy was immediately hired by the Jews of New Orleans, where he served for 4 years. His son wrote, when they came to New Orleans, only four homes were kosher. Within a year, every Jew kept a kosher home. A very forceful personality. So he left in 1865 after many Confederate Jews fled New Orleans north, mostly Reform. The shul itself changed. He became the Rav in St. Louis and Cincinnati, where he died in 1871, Gimel Tammuz. By coincidence, the yahrzeit of Lubavitcher Rebbe, Gimel Tammuz, 1871. Now, there was lay support for slavery as well. One person we mentioned time and again, Mordechai Manuel Noah, spoke more bluntly. He said, blacks are anatomically and mentally inferior to the white, and so servile labor was most appropriate for them. And much of their concern was business related, that the economies of the North and South would suffer great upheaval if slavery was outlawed. So here's Noah. The bonds of society must be kept as they now are. To emancipate slaves would be to jeopardize the safety of the whole country. Again, Ki Bishlomo, Yelachem Shalom. Of course, many Jews were bitterly opposed to slavery as immoral, and Raphael's sermon was lambasted by David Einhorn, one of the most prominent Reform rabbis of the day, also German Jew, rabbi in Baltimore, grew up in a religious home, attended yeshiva in Firth. Then he was influenced at a series of German universities, became radical Reform. He hated slavery. It has ever been a strategy of the advocate of a bad cause to take refuge from the spirit of the Bible to its letter. And he was moved to respond to Morris Raphael just a few weeks later. And he said of Morris Raphael, exaggerated Ted, to allow his beloved slavery to appear in the full glory of holiness, the revered speaker surrounds it with the prestige of remotest antiquity to prove that it existed already before the deluge. And it must be confessed that this evidence, as given, is presented in a very ingenious manner, and in its skill exceeds the capacity already admired by our ancients to drive a camel through a needle's eye. That's from the New Testament, by the way, but just an aside. In his own impulse to create, the pious speaker does not take the least notice of the story of creation, although it tells us, and God created man in his image. Man and woman, he created them. God blessed them, said to them, be fruitful, multiply, have dominion over the fish of the sea, fowl of the air, over every living thing that creepeth upon the earth. Here no mention is made of dominion over the Negro. He got a little carried away, weakened his argument, claiming that just because Noah mentioned slavery, ergo, Negro slavery must have been dominant before the great catastrophe, as if that's what Raphael was claiming. But that's not what he said. It's a polemical tactic. Create a straw man that distorts what your adversary said, and then knock down that straw man. But he added that if slavery predated the flood, that proves its immorality. That generation was destroyed, which is a clever argument. And he denied that slaves are considered property under Jewish law, wrongly, but he rightly distinguished between the Eved Kanani and the Southern slave. And he used colorful invective in depicting Raphael's arguments. Wretched foolery, gross ignorance, called him a queer prophet, absurd, nonsensical. But the moral argument was compelling, and he concluded with this peroration. I quote, "I am no politician and do not meddle in politics, but to proclaim slavery in the name of Judaism to be a God-sanctioned institution, the Jewish religious press must raise objections to this if it does not want itself in Judaism branded forever. Had a Christian clergyman in Europe deliver the Raphael address, the Jewish Orthodox, as well as Jewish Reform press, would have been set going to call the wrath of heaven and earth upon such falsehoods, to denounce such disgrace, and chil Hashem. And are we in America to ignore this mischief done by a Jewish preacher? Only such Jews who prize the dollar more highly than their God and their religion can demand or even approve of this." To Einhorn, slavery was the cancer of the Union, and he said movingly, "Does the Negro have less ability to think, to feel, to will? Does he have less of a desire to happiness? Was he born not to be entitled to all these? Slavery is immoral and must be abolished." In response to this sermon, remember, Baltimore, Maryland, they went either way. Einhorn was attacked by a mob. He was nearly tarred and feathered, and he was literally run out of town. He fled Baltimore for the safety of Philadelphia, became the rabbi there, moving to New York in 1866. There are others noted, they mentioned, that Eved doesn't mean slave as much as it means servant or bondman. And the truth is, most rabbis in the North opposed slavery. Raphael was the outlier. One outspoken supporter of Lincoln and antagonist of slavery was was Rabbi Sabato More, who had become the rabbi of Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia, and to whom we will yet return when I recover my voice. In any event, in conclusion, these strong feelings on either side of the debate, as mirrored in the arguments between Raphael and Einhorn, are but faint echoes of the clamorous discord that prevailed in the United States in the 1850s. In 1856, on the floor of Congress, During an argument over slavery, a South Carolina congressman beat Senator Sumner from Massachusetts with a cane until he was unconscious. He didn't pull a pistol on him. I guess that was a saving grace. Around the same time, which is a month earlier, John Brown killed 5 pro-slavery settlers. In 1857, the Supreme Court decided the Dred Scott case. Dred Scott was a slave who sued for his freedom because of his residence in Missouri, a free state. The court ruled against Scott, holding that blacks had no claim to freedom or to citizenship. And to Buchanan, who, by the way, influenced the court to rule this way, to Buchanan, that had resolved the issue once and for all. Christian denominations, Methodists, Baptists, would also split formally into northern and southern factions, churches that had nothing to do with each other. And in that sense, the Jewish divide was just a reflection of the general divide as well. Civil War would soon erupt, and the questions were, would the Union survive? Should the Union survive? Was it worth war, suffering, dislocation, hardship to keep a house divided against itself together? So 4 men we discussed tonight are all ranked with good reason at the very bottom in the hierarchy of American presidents. They could not answer these questions at all. One man would try. He would carve out a new path for America away from the immorality of slavery. The man who, by most accounts, is rated the most important, if not the best, president in American history. That's Abraham Lincoln, and we'll tell his story next week. I thank you all very much. Oh, once again, we're sponsored by Becky Navi Katz. Well, Elon, this was Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, and I thank them as always for their sponsorship.